Okay, well, thank you again for coming to our weekly case lecture. And as most of you know, the point of these lectures is to address a topic of interest to the campus and beyond from a Christian perspective, and for a topic of contemporary significance to be addressed with the tools and the focus that the Christian worldview brings along. And so today I'm very pleased to be able to give this talk on Richard Dawkins and Christians' Reasoning. I want to say up front, hi Beck, there's a hand out at the door there. I want to say up front that I'm not a scientist, and many of you know that. And my PhD is in literature, and I run an apologetics centre. So my interest in Richard Dawkins doesn't arise from his own background in sciences, and I know many of you here have a lot more to say in response to his claims about genetics, for example, than I will even attempt to say. But what I am interested in is how Richard Dawkins approaches arguments about religion, how he discusses the arguments for the existence of God, and how he employs rhetoric, polemic, and particular techniques of argument to make his case. I thought I should begin today with a prayer, and you've got it there in your handouts, and don't feel you need to join me, I'll pray for you. Oh Lord, grant me the serenity to accept the fact that you are a figment of my imagination, the courage to face my miserable life without pretending you're somehow there for me, and the wisdom to stop hanging up stupid prayer placards in my kitchen. Amen. This comes from a book I have on my shelf called You Are Worthless, Depressing Nuggets of Wisdom, Sure to Ruin Your Day. I've got quite a few books like this on my shelf. And the authors, I think, could really take their place as wardens in the new churches of atheism that Richard Dawkins is trying to form. In fact, in the appendix to The God Delusion, the book we're going to discuss today, actually, how many have seen this or dipped into it or read about it at least? Just so I know, half of us have. Okay. In the appendix to that book, the author gives a list of atheist organisations which he urges you to join. So there is a real agenda to this publishing. It is not objective or remote scholarship. It's actually an attempt, maybe leave it open, Karen, just for the breeze to come through here. It's an attempt to promote a particular view of life. And I think we need to read the book in that context, that it is, in fact, very appropriate for an apologist to respond to it, because it's a work of apologetics itself. So Dawkins is in no ivory tower, despite having a chair at Oxford. He's not a leather armchair atheist. He actually gets out on the street and wants to convert people to his view of the world. And he reminds me actually of many of the passionate preachers and church growth experts and evangelists that we meet in our travels as Christians. And some of them we may connect with, and they may change our lives. Others we feel like we want to run away a million miles. And I don't know where you fit into on the Richard Dawkins responses to Richard Dawkins, but I know people fall into both camps. In fact, you'll see on your handout there pictures from his birthday. It was his birthday on Sunday, his 66th birthday. And on his website, richarddawkins.net, they listed 3,260 birthday messages for Richard Dawkins from people around the world. And various of his churches kind of sent off messages. So you have the California Society for Atheists sending off a message with a picture of their group meeting and discussing his book. And I've given you just a photo from the website there of various people who sent in pictures of themselves with Dawkins' book as if it were a Bible, or as if it were the text which shapes their lives. Or, you know, people, when they're holding a book, you're rarely just holding a book, especially if you're holding it up. You're always allowing that book to represent you in some way. This is who I am. And those photos, I thought, were very telling. There's so many people who sent off the picture of themselves with Richard Dawkins' book as their worldview representative. So this is a perhaps growing movement, and certainly on the website there's a sense of excitement among readers of Dawkins that their view of the world is catching on, that their approach to questions of religion, the place of religion in Western society in particular, arguments about the existence of God and arguments for the non-existence of God, that these kinds of discussions are grabbing hold of people and making a difference today. And one of the birthday messages there that really struck me was a friend of Richard's that said, "Dear Richard, it's a pleasure to be your friend. Keep on changing the world." Changing the world, a term that evangelists use. So this is the message, this is the context in which we read Dawkins' book today. So in this lecture, I'm hoping, one last point there is, he is really on a mission to rid the world of religion. It's nothing less than that. And early in the book, he says, and I quote, "If this book works as I intend, religious readers who open it will be atheists when they put it down." So in a sense, you know, it should come with a warning label, in a sense like all religious books, that this book is meant to change you when you read it. So it'll be interesting to reflect on the experiences that we have as we read the book and whether it does in fact change anything about our worldviews. So in this brief lecture, I want to explore the claims of this book, The God Delusion, in particular to offer five responses to what I think are the five main arguments that the book has, or the main complaints that Dawkins has against religion. In particular, but not exclusively, against Christianity. Christianity is one of his targets, but it is religion more generally that Dawkins is opposed to. So I've got five, I want to outline his five arguments and then give five responses, which are in various states of development as I've been doing my own reading, and I look forward to your contribution to that. Firstly, a little bit of background on Dawkins for those who haven't come across him before. It's getting a bit noisy there, Robert, isn't it? He describes himself as having a childhood that was a normal Anglican upbringing. That is, he had C of E parents who were C and E. You know the phrase? Church of England parents who went to church Christmas and Easter. C of E who were C and E. He grew up in Kenya, and then he went to boarding school in England, and then went on to study biology at Oxford. Describes his childhood as really quite settled. He's not someone who claims to have been abused as a child. And in the book, he talks about religion as a form of abusing children. He himself feels that he had a generally normal upbringing where religion was on the edges of his experience. It was there, but it wasn't pushed in any way. So he went to study biology at Oxford and did very well, and spent some time teaching in America, and then published his first book called The Selfish Gene in 1976, which I understand was received with quite a lot of acclaim. It was very influential. And in this book, he talks about the role of genes in evolution. And I look forward to Peter's comments on it later on. He had more to say than I would. That was followed by other books which speak about religious questions in relation to nature. Since his topic really is religious questions in relation to nature. And so his books have wonderful titles like The Blind Watchmaker, a response to arguments of design, River Out of Eden, Unweaving the Rainbow, both very biblical titles, and others. All of these books work to dispel the idea that religion has any substance to it and to replace it with an idea of science as a comprehensive worldview. By the age of 16, he was convinced that Darwinism explained life. He didn't read Darwin until a little later, but he heard about Darwinism, about the theory of evolution, and having been confirmed as an Anglican at 13, in the next 3 years, thoroughly discarded religion and was convinced that Darwinism really did explain everything that we needed to know about life. And one of the themes he comes back to is how satisfying Darwinism is to him in understanding life. So he'd lost any childhood faith by that point, except for an interest in the argument from design. And this is the residue, perhaps, of his religious upbringing. That he begins the God Delusion book with a boy lying on his back and admiring the natural world, being just fascinated with it and overcome with awe at the complexity and wonder of the natural world. And it's not hard to imagine Dawkins as a young, incredibly bright, naturalistically inclined boy observing the creatures of Kenya and and being thrilled by what he saw. But that boy in the story, in the God's Illusion, goes on to become a chaplain because he's convinced by what he sees in the world that there must be a God to explain it. Dawkins went the other way. He was convinced by Darwinism that he didn't need God to explain the complexity and wonder of the world. That the wonder is not under question mark here. He later ditched his interest in the argument from design and became an anti-design proponent. And we'll talk a bit in detail about his anti-design arguments in the God Delusion. This is somewhere I'd really appreciate the help of the science people in understanding where the science and the philosophy intersect. He's now the Charles Simonyi, I think that's how you pronounce it, Professor for Public Understanding of Science at Oxford, which is a privately endowed chair, seemingly for the purposes of promoting Darwinism. He's called the Professor for Public Understanding of Science, which means that he basically does talks promoting Darwinism and atheism. And so this is funded by this fellow who was a programmer at Microsoft, incredibly wealthy and philanthropic man, Charles Simonyi. And Dawkins, I think, is the first in the chair. So having turned 66 now, he's something of a senior authority in academic circles, but has never stayed in the ivory tower. And I think his popularity can be explained by the fact that he writes the kind of books that you pick up, read, and either love or hate. You have to react to what he says. And there's certainly a lot to react to in the God Delusion. Let me give you a few of those rhetorical flourishes from Dawkins, just to have a feel, if you haven't dipped into him before, for the style of his writing. So in the first substantial chapter of the book, chapter 2, after he's introduced his subject, he's going to present the God hypothesis, the argument about God and why people believe in God. And this is how he does it, beginning of the chapter. The God of the Old Testament is arguably the most unpleasant character in all fiction. Jealous and proud of it. A petty, unjust, unforgiving control freak. A vindictive, bloodthirsty ethnic cleanser. A misogynistic, homophobic, racist, infanticidal, genocidal, filicidal, pestilential, megalomaniacal, sadomasochistic, capriciously malevolent bully. It's one of those great opening sentences in a book. Now, there really isn't much room to move in the God Hypothesis chapter after you've introduced it like that. Instantly, his views on God are very plain. Not only does he present God as all of these horrendous, having all these horrendous qualities, but you notice at the beginning, the most unpleasant character in all fiction. The question of there being any real substance to the God of the Old Testament is just put aside by the use of the word fiction. He uses this kind of aggressive and impressive flourish to great effect throughout the book before people find that their prejudices either being totally confirmed or they're back up so much that they can barely respond to what's here. He's also very fond of using anecdotes as a way of impressing you that his argument must be strong. He will damn ideas with his choice of words. For example, he calls the passing on of the belief in God a virus. And we all know a virus is a very bad thing. If he'd chosen the word a medicine, perhaps, or even a particle that passed on, it would have a neutrality to it. But the word virus instantly means we know it's a bad thing. These are important because much of his power comes from his rhetoric and not his arguments. He refuses over and over again to actually acknowledge any of the probabilistic approaches to religious questions, any of the discussions about God's existence that build on let's look at the likelihood of certain things happening or the likelihood of God having this quality or that. These are totally dismissed by Dawkins. In fact, he is very critical of perhaps the doyen of the probabilistic approach to the philosophy of religion, Richard Swinburne, in a very cruel and dismissive way for someone who is a key authority in philosophy of religion, having published most of the major textbooks in the major questions in that area. Swinburne, I think, has been very generous in his responses to Dawkins, playing only the argument and not the man. And there are lessons in that that I'll come back to. The final point of rhetoric I wanted to raise before we look at the arguments is that Dawkins really assumes agreement from his readers. He doesn't put forward cases that you can assess. He assumes that you will be with him. And by using a very emotional approach, it's hard not to be with him. When God is described as such a tyrant, it's very hard to stand up and say, well, that's not the God that I know, or that's not the God that I've read about. He squeezes his readers into a pathway that means you need to follow him. All right, well, let's look then very briefly at the five arguments that he presents and then five responses to them. Now, I'll do them on your handouts. You've got arguments and then responses later, but I'm going to do each argument and response together. I hope that's not too confusing. His first argument presented the next chapter of the book is that none of the arguments for God's existence work. None of the arguments for God's existence actually work, according to Dawkins. Now, any of you who have studied any of the alleged proofs for the existence of God will know that this is an area of great intrigue in philosophy of religion and continual investigation. Its heyday was perhaps back in the 13th century with Thomas Aquinas, who offered his proofs for the existence of God. But before him and after him, thinkers have been intrigued in this question of whether we can rationally conclude that God exists, whether we can use proofs, whether we can use logic to assert that God exists. Dawkins works through the various proofs about God, the argument about cause, Aquinas's cosmological argument, the argument about the unmoved mover. I won't go into all of these, dismissing them all one by one as being having been disproven by other philosophers. He does not actually enter into any of the arguments to provide his own perspective on why they don't work. He simply asserts that we've come to the view now that they don't work. But the one that interests him most is the argument from design, or otherwise known as the teleological argument. So in brief, that argument is that when you look at the world, things appear to be designed. It's that experience that the boy has when he gazes on the complexity of what he sees in the grass, or he looks at the sky above and is struck by how incredible it is and starts to ponder how the universe works and thinks that this looks like something that could not have taken place by chance. This looks like something that has purpose, and purpose is a very important word. We know that things don't look designed unless there's a designer behind them, and therefore we come back to the argument that there is a God. That's the kind of flow of the argument from design. Dawkins' complaint against this argument is that he thinks Darwin knocked it on the head. He thinks that a proper understanding of evolution, proper understanding of natural selection, will show you that the argument has no strength to it. That things can look designed and yet have come about by chance. So his response to that is complex and informs his scientific work informs that. But the basic assertion is that something can look designed and yet have come about by chance. This reaction to the argument for design leads us to the second important argument that he raises, and that is that there is an argument for God's non-existence that actually works. According to Dawkins, there is an argument for God's non-existence, for atheism, that works. So it's not just that none of the arguments for God's existence work, it's that he has an argument that can show you that it is nearly provable that God doesn't exist. Here's what it is. He calls it the ultimate Boeing 747 argument. The ultimate Boeing 747. That is, people who are proponents of the argument from design say that, well, when you look at, if you looked at a Boeing 747, you would never come to the conclusion that it had been gathered together by chance. Someone had to come up with that. It needed some intelligence. It needed some strategy, some purpose to come about. Someone had to design it. That's a version of the argument from design for God's existence. Dawkins says, well, that may be the case. Let's go with that argument for a little while. Let's imagine that there is a complex universe. But to create a complex universe, the creator must be more complex than the thing created. To end up with a complex universe, you have to have an intelligence, something that is more complex than the thing it has created. Therefore, he says, if the universe is improbable, God is even more improbable. If the universe is improbable, God is even more improbable. So perhaps the most effective form of the argument from design these days is known as the anthropic principle. Many of you have heard of this. But it's so unlikely that the conditions for life could exist in our world that the best explanation is someone set it up that way. There's my art student's version of a scientific argument for why we have life on Earth. But it's so improbable that the universe could come about by chance in such a way that it would support life that it makes much more sense to believe someone designed it. Well, Dawkins says, well, let's take that. It's true. If the universe is so improbable that there was someone who could design such a universe is even more improbable. That's his ultimate Boeing 747 argument. Now, I've pondered this for some time. And it does intrigue me. And not being a scientist, I try my hardest to understand things like intelligent design and understanding this evidence behind the anthropic principle. I do my best on that. I've got one response to this I want to test out on you and save up your responses for question time to see if this is right, because it's really a one-line response. I feel that this argument only works for Dawkins if God is of the same substance as the universe. It only works if God is of the same stuff. Then the designer would need to be more complex than the thing designed. But Christian theologians, by and large, have never asserted that God is of the same substance as the universe. And so I cannot see how this argument works at all in the questions of God. Please come back and talk to me about that one, see if I'm right. Third of his arguments is that Darwin's theory of evolution really does explain everything. Darwin's theory of evolution really will take us where we want to go. Here's the summary, the 6-point summary of his view. He says, one of the greatest challenges to the human intellect, this is on page 157 if you want to look it up, one of the greatest challenges to the human intellect over the centuries has been to explain how the complex, improbable appearance of design in the universe arises. Two, our natural temptation is to attribute the appearance of design to actual design itself. In case of a man-made artifact such as a watch, the designer really was an intelligent engineer. It's tempting to apply the same logic to an eye, a wing, a spider, or a person. Three, the temptation is a false one, because the designer hypothesis immediately raises the larger problem of who designed the designer. The whole problem we started out with was the problem of explaining statistical improbability. It's obviously no solution to postulate something even more improbable. He comes back to that point. Fourthly, he then says, we need a crane, not a skyhook, to explain this. For only a crane can do the business of working up gradually and plausibly from simplicity to otherwise improbable complexity. Have people heard these terms before, cranes and skyhooks? A crane is something that can lift a great weight, but it's grounded beneath the weight. It can lift it up because it's grounded beneath. A skyhook comes from above and just lifts it up with no kind of support. So he's saying what religious people do is offer skyhooks, God, to lift up this huge problem of how we have a seemingly designed universe. He says, no, what we need is a crane that lifts it up from the bottom, that using the principles we already have. So then his fourth point makes sense. The most ingenious and powerful crane so far discovered is Darwinian evolution by natural selection. Darwin and his successors have shown how living creatures, with their spectacular statistical improbability and appearance of design, have evolved by slow gradual degrees from simple beginnings. We can now safely say that the illusion of design in living creatures is just that, an illusion. Fifthly, we don't yet have an equivalent crane for physics. And here's where he admits he has work to do, or someone has work to do. And he explores that a little bit more. And sixthly, we should not give up hope of a better crane arising in physics, something as powerful as Darwinism is for biology. But even in the absence of a strongly satisfying crane to match the biological one, the relatively weak cranes we have at present are, when abetted by the anthropic principle, self-evidently better than the self-defeating skyhook hypothesis of an intelligent designer. So his view really is that Darwinian evolution gives us all we need. My question here is whether we really have only a biologist speaking. When he says we have all we need here, he admits that physicists would not agree with him. They don't have all they need. Are we just having the biologist speak here, who is so thoroughly satisfied with the realm of biology that he has forgotten all the other realms of life? Or does he really think that biological explanation will give us satisfactory answers in every realm of life, in the realm of relationships, in the realm of our understanding of the physical world, in the realm of our understanding of the universe itself and its origins? It seems to me that for Dawkins, unlike others, biological explanations are everything. And I wonder if others in, certainly those in philosophy, have not been very happy with what Dawkins has put forward, and say that there are no satisfying philosophical explanations here in this book. Fourth argument that he puts forward is that the presence of religion can be explained by genes and memes, M-E-M-E-S, genes and memes. And in some of his other works, he introduces this concept of the meme that we need to look at briefly now. A meme is really the kind of knowledge equivalent, or cultural, or social, or cognitive equivalent of a gene. So a gene has a certain amount of information that's passed on through various pathways and associations and mutations and whatever. A meme is the kind of meaningful bit of the gene, so to speak, that passes on beliefs, or passes on ideas, or passes on propensities that human beings might have. Now, this is a reasonably complex area. In my short reading on it, I understand that meme theory itself is not particularly well regarded these days. But let's go with it for a little while. Dawkins' idea is that there are certain human kind of intellectual capacities that get passed on. He doesn't tell us how they're passed on. He says they are passed on. I'll read you some of the examples of those. This is page 199. He says, the following is a partial list of religious memes that might plausibly have survival value in the meme pool. It's like the gene pool. Either because they have some absolute merit, or because of their compatibility with some other existing memoplex, i.e. some existing set of ideas. There are things like, you will survive your own death. He says, the reason human beings believe this is it has some sort of survival value and gets passed on. Another one is, if you die a martyr, you'll go to a especially wonderful part of paradise where you'll enjoy 72 virgins. Spare a thought for the unfortunate virgins, he says. A rather ridiculing kind of concept to bring up from the Islamic religion. Another one, he says, that's passed on is, belief in God is a supreme virtue. If you find your belief wavering, you should restore it. Another one is, faith is a virtue. So he plucks out these concepts that he thinks are passed on by way of memes because they have some natural selection value. And that's why religion continues. Now, it won't take many courses in sociology or courses in cultural studies or anything to feel that this is a somewhat out of area comment for a biologist to be making. Either he does think that the biological basis explains all of these things, or he doesn't. Seems to me the memes are a chance to have his cake and eat it too, and say that there is some sort of cultural vehicle that passes on these ideas that's not really explained by the genetics, but is postulated as this kind of genetic-like entity that somehow comes down the generations. No mechanism is given for this. It's really a postulation. And his fifth and final argument then for within the book is that, and it's a very strong one, and this one I think is perhaps the key to why Dawkins does the things he does. Now, you know, who can know why a person acts the way they do, but this one seems to me to be very powerful in explaining why there's such energy behind the Dawkins phenomenon. His fifth argument is that religious morality is actually immoral, and that religion brings no good into the world. So his fifth argument is really a moral argument. And in the second half of the book, in fact throughout, but mainly in the second half of the book, he gives all kinds of examples of where he thinks religion is immoral, from things like martyrdom, through to what he calls the abuse of children by catechizing them when they're young, when they can't think for themselves, through to attitudes to homosexuality, through to the nature of God's activities in the Old Testament. All of these moral behaviours offend Dawkins to no end. And he assumes his readers will be offended to the same extent, and is himself very offended when they are not, or when they offer any defence. Now, there are many things in this book that I, as a Christian, would never offer defence for. I would never offer any defence for kind of homophobic attitudes that people have. I would never offer any defence for the brainwashing of people against their will. But there are responses to his criticisms of the morality of religion, and he seems to be incredibly angry whenever anyone doesn't agree with his moral conclusions. In fact, Dawkins offers his own Ten Commandments, and I think I've lost the page number for this, but let's see if I can find it quickly. Yep, in what I think is a stunning example of how moral his campaign is. He offers a set of commandments that he thinks we ought to live by today. There's no basis for them that is given. They're just the commandments he thinks are right. He mentions some that other people have mentioned, things like don't do to others what you wouldn't want them to do to you. Sounds like a familiar a familiar teaching. In all things strive to cause no harm. Treat your fellow human beings, your fellow living things, and the world in general with love, honesty, faithfulness and respect. No problems there at all. But then he adds in things like enjoy your own sex life, so long as it damages nobody else, and leave others to enjoy theirs in private, whatever their inclinations, which are none of your business. Do not discriminate or oppress on basis of sex, race, or as far as possible, species. Do not indoctrinate your children. Teach them how to think for themselves, how to evaluate evidence, how to disagree with you, and value the future on a timescale longer than your own. Now, it stuns me that these are here, because not that I necessarily want to disagree with every point that's being made, but just that there is no structure at all to why these things are offered. They are just considered to be part of the mood of the times, the zeitgeist is the word that he uses, that everyone would agree with. So they're put forward as the way we ought to live without any reference to God. These are the things Dawkins hopes will emerge within the human experience, within the churches that he is founding, as the natural and proper way of living without a God. I have to say, I wish him luck. I wish him luck, and his optimism is stunning, that such views would be held and perpetuated by people around the world in an atheistic state. In fact, one of the main complaints people have had about the book is that he does not seem to acknowledge the damage atheism has done. He does not seem to acknowledge the downside of atheism, morally speaking, and people refer back to Hitler and so forth, and he has a discussion about Hitler in the early part of the book. If you're interested in that, Alistair McGrath has written a book called The Twilight of Atheism, which we featured in the latest Case magazine, responding or explaining and exploring this claim that atheism would come up with a better moral universe than theism, and how wanting it was in the 20th century. So the suggestion, the second part of that suggestion, is that religion really has brought no good into the world. And this is where many of us are just baffled at Dawkins' claims. Even if you were to take a bald measure of the amount of good that religion has brought into the world and measure it up to the amount of evil, you'd at least have something on the good side, even if you didn't think it was in the majority. But when you become more scientific about this, we find there's actually very good evidence developing for the positive impact of religion in the world. So a study is cited in another book by McGrath, Dawkins' God, Genes, Memes and the Meaning of Life, page 110. A meta-survey in 2001 of 100 evidence-based studies looking at the relationship between religion and human well-being. And these studies came to these conclusions. 79 of them reported at least one positive correlation between religious involvement and well-being. 79%. 13 found no meaningful association between religion and well-being. 7 found mixed or complex associations between religion and well-being. And 1 found a negative association between religion and well-being. If you were being a scientist and referring to studies like this, you would have to come to the conclusion that religion has overwhelmingly brought well-being into the world. 79% of studies find that. Only 8% of studies are even conflated about that, or even, that's not the word, are even not certain about that. Only 8% bring any kind of negative assessment to religion in terms of what it brings into the world. So it really seems that Dawkins will rely on the emotional power of his argument and the anecdotal cases of where religion has gone wrong, which Christians need not defend because they're indefensible. It seems he relies on that for the power of his argument that religious morality is in fact immoral. All right, well, before stopping and leaving some time for questions, can I just offer a few thoughts about responding to Dawkins as a Christian apologist. You see, I said at the beginning, this to me is a work of apologetics for atheism. And so what does a Christian apologist, someone who is convinced of the truth of Christianity, say in response to it? How do we go about it? At one level, I didn't really want to have to engage with this book. I'm not someone who enjoys a fight, really. I love another fighter. And I would rather just leave it to be read and consumed by people and do their own thing. But really, there's a necessity to respond to a book like this. It rose to the top of the bestseller lists for non-fiction very quickly. People are drawn to it. 3,000 birthday wishes to Richard Dawkins. People they want this to be true. So what does that say about people's the feeling people have towards religion? There's obviously a sense of negativity there that needs to be responded to and demands a response. Even spiritually non-aligned academics can see that Dawkins' claims need to be responded to. So take Terry Eagleton, another professor at Oxford, a wonderful writer himself and a Marxist. I'm not quite sure where he stands in relation to Christianity. But he said in his review of Dawkins' book at the beginning, "Imagine someone holding forth on biology, whose only knowledge of the subject is the Book of British Birds, and you have a rough idea of what it feels like to read Richard Dawkins on theology." Now that really chuffed me, that line. It's not the way I'd want to say things, but there's great truth to it, that when Dawkins does try to deal with theological questions, it's as if he hasn't done any reading. It's as if he's expecting his audience just to believe what he says. It's as if he doesn't have to engage with theologians. He said as much, that he thinks theology is fairy tales, and so he refuses to engage with it. Well, he ought not to comment on it then, if he's refusing to engage in it. So it requires a response because of the way in which it is written. But the great temptation, I think, for Christian apologists, for Christians who want to engage in this debate, is to respond in kind to Dawkins. The book itself is so belligerent and self-assured in tone that I think it will shoot itself in the foot with many readers. Christians really ought to model in the way they respond to this book the things that they do believe. That is, Christians should respond in graciousness, humility and honesty to this book. And I've tried very hard to avoid the kind of Dawkins is a dork response to the book which I've seen here and there. It's hard to do because it can make you very angry when you read someone who obviously has not done the homework in areas where you have some knowledge. But there are real intellectual concerns behind his anger and sarcasm, and they need to be addressed. I think also that we Christians can acknowledge where Dawkins is actually correct about religion, and we can help to distinguish the Christian gospel from religion itself. After all, Christians do believe the gospel is unique in that it offers us God coming to us rather than us having to wrestle our way to God. And many of the problems I think Dawkins has with religion are to do with this sense that you have to wrestle your way to God. Christianity is all of grace, from God to us, and that news ought to stand out, so we need to clarify that when we talk about Dawkins. We also should acknowledge that there is a great wide range of Christian belief and practice, and not all of it is defensively Christian. People who will claim the name of Christian will not always be acting in a way that is identifiably Christian. I'm not going to spend any time defending the Christian who called Dawkins, and is cited in this book, a Satan-worshipping scum. I don't think that's a defensible attitude or claim, and I can't imagine God being very happy with that kind of comment. And nor can I defend some of the eschatological nuttiness that Dawkins ridicules, ideas about the end of the world, which I think are not derived from Scripture, or at least they're derived from a misreading of Scripture. So there are things that Dawkins ridicules and makes fun of that I don't think are demonstrably Christian and don't need to be defended. Finally, I think as with the Da Vinci Code, there's a great opportunity here with this book in the bestseller list to really clarify what it means to be a Christian and where Christians are engaged in the intellectual process, where we want to have arguments and discussions, where we want to do the research, where we are friends of science, where we are interested in where scientific knowledge will take us and what we want to add to that as Christians. I sense that the better way to be engaged with Dawkins will be to be led by 1 Corinthians 13 in an attitude of love, which doesn't want to be a clanging bell, have all knowledge and have no love, but instead wants love to actually demonstrate through the truth what we think is attractive about Christianity.